funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the consequences of racism in today's United States, and how are attempts to wipe it out affecting prospects for justice and equality? While racism has been rendered socially unacceptable in contemporary society, many Americans believe it is alive and thriving under the surface, and that it continues to be the primary hindrance to the ability of many people of color to enjoy equal opportunity to those of whites. But my guest today would argue that our ideas about racism, how and when it occurs, who is victimized and who is to blame, may be a greater problem than the damage inflicted by those who harbor and act on racist beliefs. Richard Thompson Ford is George E. Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford University. His new book, just out in paperback, is called The Race Card: How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Rich, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
You argue that we need new and more nuanced definitions of racism. Can you compare how we define racism right now with what you think we need to move forward?
Yes, absolutely. Well, right now, when we think about racism, and in fact, when we think about most racial conflicts or racial inequities, we think in terms of a discrete state of mind, someone who has animus against people because of the color of their skin, or someone who harbors stereotypes, mistaken and outdated notions about what people are like because of their race. And now that certainly is a problem in today's society, and it was certainly the main problem of American race relations in the past. But I would argue that in today's society, that kind of racism is on a fairly steep decline. And instead, the racial problems that we continue to have are by and large now the result of the legacy of racism in the past, things like neighborhood segregation, the isolation of racial minorities in poor neighborhoods, and economic forces. And although racism remains a problem, I don't want to deny that, I think it's less of a problem today than it has been in the past, and these other more systemic racial inequities are the larger problem today.
At what point would you say, Rich, that those old definitions began to fail us?
Well, I would say over time they have gradually become less and less salient. So, clearly in the 1960s, when the omnibus federal civil rights laws were passed, the kind of classic racism, simple racism, what my parents would have called simple color prejudice, was a huge problem. It was quite pervasive and responsible for a lot of the problems that people of color suffered in this country. Now, over time, because of the success of the civil rights movement, those attitudes have become less and less prevalent. And I think with each passing generation, they're becoming less widespread and less severe. And yet, racial problems and racial inequities persist. More and more, that's the result of the legacy of racism in the past. I mean, and again, neighborhood segregation would be the example I would point to most prominently. But I think over the past 10 or so years, we've really seen the point where the old definition of racism is much less the problem, and the more systemic concerns are what we need to attack today.
And in fact, because of those systemic concerns, you think in 2009 it is entirely possible to have racism without racists. Can you talk about how that works?
Sure. I think here's an example. When Hurricane Katrina hit, and many people noticed that a vastly disproportionate number of the victims of Katrina were black, the people who had been forced out of their homes, the people who were left behind in New Orleans in terrible conditions. Many people, and perhaps the most striking example was when the musician Kanye West said, George Bush doesn't care about black people. But many people expressed similar sentiments. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, for instance, said that compared temporary shelters in New Orleans to the hull of a slave ship, again evoking the kind of simple color prejudice, the just vicious racism as the problem But in fact, what was going on in Hurricane Katrina was more complex than that. What you had was neighborhood segregation, again, where African Americans were disproportionately in the low-lying areas of the city, in the less desirable areas, and those areas that were most heavily impacted by the flooding when the levees broke. And in addition, the neglect of public infrastructure led to levees that wouldn't survive the hurricane, and the neglect of social programs that included disaster relief like FEMA. Now, that led to a racially disparate result, and I would say a racial injustice, to be sure. But without racists, it's hard to find the racist that's to blame for what happened in Hurricane Katrina. And it wasn't clear that President Bush, for instance, cared less about blacks than about whites. Instead, it was the result of the segregation, the result of racism in the past, and these other factors, the neglect of the infrastructure, the neglect of social programs that led to the racially disparate results. So there's an example of racism without racists.
Why do you think, Rich, that our thinking right now sort of requires a bad guy to blame for the effects of racism?
Well, that's a good question. I think there are a few reasons. One has to do with the law. Civil rights law, the core of civil rights laws involves finding racism and remedying racial discrimination, which the courts typically defined as a discrete state of mind. We call it discriminatory intent. Now, there are other civil rights laws, which I talk about in the book, but that's the core, and I think that's the core not only for the courts and for lawyers, but also in the minds of most people, that most people, when they think of a racial injustice, they think, well, there's a racist who's actively discriminating because they don't like black people or they don't like people of color. And then in addition, I think just in day-to-day life, the moral condemnation and is such a big part of the way we go about thinking about racial questions that most people look for a racist to blame when there's a racial injustice. And that, unfortunately, has become almost the only way that we deal with racial problems.
And ultimately, what that allows us to do is to sort of look at ourselves and say, well, I'm not a racist, therefore I'm not part of the problem and can't really be part of the solution.
That's right. I think that, I mean, that's one of the biggest costs of this way of thinking, that we're caught up in morally condemning the racist. And on the one hand, that leads people to point the finger of blame when it's not deserved. On the other hand, as you suggest, that leads people to say, well, I'm not a racist, and therefore it's not my problem, and to become angry anytime someone brings up a racial issue, because the first reaction is, hey, wait a minute, I'm not a racist. Are you calling me a racist? Rather than looking at racial inequity as a social problem, something that we've all inherited as a result of the blatantly racially discriminatory past in this country, and something that we can all contribute to fixing without having to say that an individual is morally blameworthy.
You mentioned already the effects of housing segregation that have lasted longer, far longer than the laws that put them in place. Can you talk about some of the other places where you think racial injustice is most evident and most harmful in today's America?
Yes, and a lot of them actually stem from housing segregation. It's one of the reasons that I bring that up. But school segregation and the disproportionate concentration of minorities in failing schools or troubled schools, that's another legacy of the past. I don't think, by and large, it's the case that cities or school districts are deliberately trying to shunt minorities off to the worst schools, but it's a result of neighborhood segregation. We have that educational inequity that's a problem in most metropolitan areas in the U.S. The criminal justice system and the vast, vast, vastly disproportionate representation of African Americans, particularly young black men, in the prison population, either imprisoned in jail or on parole, that's another consequence of racism in the past. Again, segregation, which concentrates minorities into poor neighborhoods where there are lack of job opportunities, where crime is a big problem, and where kids, without role models that are involved in the mainstream economy, without other opportunities, find it all too easy to get pulled into criminal behavior.
Can you talk for a minute about the difference between legal and cultural racism?
Interesting. Legal. Well, as I mentioned before, the law defines racism in primarily in terms of a state of mind and a discrete discriminatory action, an employer who refuses to hire someone because of their race. Now, there is another legal definition that I think is very important, and I talk about it in the book, that involves policies that have what we call a disparate impact, meaning they're policies that inadvertently and without discriminatory intent screen out a disproportionate number of racial minorities. So those are two ways that the law defines race discrimination. But I think the idea of discriminatory intent is really the one that's captured the public imagination. And the truth is it's also, for many lawyers and judges think, it's the core of race discrimination. Now, in terms of cultural discrimination, and I'm not sure what you meant to refer to by that.
Well, I suppose there's the issue of race that can be handled perhaps by the law or not, depending on how effective policy is. And then there's the other, you know, you can't outlaw someone harboring certain attitudes, but certainly it would seem as if a lot of civil rights law had been attempting to make people understand that, that certain kinds of behavior are not okay.
Oh, yes, I see. So the idea to transform the culture. Well, I think that that's right, that one of the big victories of the civil rights movement has been to make racism unacceptable, to convince a majority of Americans that they ought to rethink the prejudiced attitudes of the past and to make people feel that it's a bad thing, that it's shameful to be a bigot. Now, the law can't do that directly. As you say, we don't have thought control and we can't outlaw attitudes or ideas, but the law has contributed to, along with social protest movements, along with changes in the media, all these things have contributed to changing the culture, I think, in a very profound way. And that probably more than the ability of someone to file a lawsuit is responsible for the greater racial justice that we enjoy today.
Richard Thompson Ford is my guest. He is George E. Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford University. His book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. We'll be back in a moment and talk about other groups that are using the race card in contemporary America and the impact that has. You're welcome to join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Richard Thompson Ford is my guest. He's George E. Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford. His new book, just out in paperback now, is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Rich, you write that like most experiments that work, the civil rights struggle has spawned imitators. How successful are other groups in playing the race card to achieve their goals?
Well, it depends on the group, but many groups have been somewhat successful. And I do want to say that in some cases, the use of the civil rights struggle is appropriate, that the analogies are correct. But in some cases, it's more questionable. An example, Southwest Airlines had a policy, and I believe still has a policy, that very, very overweight customers who couldn't fit into one seat in a coach class airplane would be required to purchase two seats. And they actually kind of euphemistically called it their customer of size policy. Well, most airlines have a policy like this, but Southwest enforced it when the planes were full. And they were met with a protest which suggested that this was a form of discrimination like race discrimination, that it was like making Rosa Parks sit in the back of the bus. You know, if it were black people that they were discriminating against, they'd never be able to get away with it. And so you had this direct analogy between the Southwest policy that they considered it to be discrimination on the basis of weight and racism. And, you know, now I think that's kind of a questionable analogy. In fact, I think it's a very questionable analogy. There are lots of reasons to think that the airlines could do a better job at accommodating their customers, but Southwest's policy wasn't like making Rosa Parks sit in the back of the bus. It didn't suggest that the management was biased against people who were overweight or bore them ill will. It was just a way for them to manage the crowded planes. And in fact, other airlines had been received complaints and even lawsuits based on customers who were kind of crammed in with people who didn't fit in the coach class seats. And so, you know, whether or not this was a wise policy, it certainly wasn't a policy that was similar to race discrimination. And yet that's what people said. There have been other examples where people who wanted to more control over the kind of clothing that they wore on the job, who had unconventional hairstyles, maybe purple hair or lots of piercings or whatever, and were told by their employers that wasn't acceptable in the workplace, said that this was discrimination on the basis of appearance. And again, you know, if it were black people, you'd never get away with this. So you get some kind of far-fetched analogies as well, as people are trying to kind of capitalize on the success of the civil rights movement.
What about the comparisons between opposition to gay marriage and the old miscegenation laws?
Well, you know, that's one that I have more sympathy with, although I also have some questions. I understand, and there is a degree of the opposition to same-sex marriage that's very much like the opposition to interracial marriage, that's based on hostility toward gay men and lesbians. But at the same time, I think that there's an assumption among a lot of people in the gay marriage movement that that's the only reason for the opposition, and that, in fact, anybody who opposes same-sex marriage is just like an anti-black bigot in the Jim Crow South. And I think that that's probably too hasty, that, in fact, some of the opposition involves religion. Some of the opposition involves what I think is, in my view, kind of a misguided but somewhat more understandable desire to retain separate gender roles. And so a lot of people are really thinking about the man and a woman. They have different roles in society. They have different roles in a family, and that's what marriage is all about. Again, that's not my view. I think that there should be same-sex marriage, that it ought to be legal. But I understand the views of people who disagree, and I don't think that they're necessarily all just anti-gay bigots.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Talking to Richard Thompson Ford about his book, The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Let's go to Tom in Dallas. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I have a question or a comment about the prison population being disproportionately black and Latino, or people of color, basically. And it seems to me that we've had hundreds of years in the country of underemployment and undereducation, you know, poor education. Consequently, we have this large population of disenfranchised people, meaning that they cannot afford decent legal representation when they get in a court situation. And in our country, unfortunately, it seems to me that if you do not have a decent attorney, you're in jail. And I was wondering what the author might have to say about that.
What do you think, Rich?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the problem. And in fact, in the criminal justice system, a lot of the people who were in jail had copped a plea. They took a plea bargain, and so that is related to being unable to afford vigorous representation all the way through trial, working with an overworked public defender who says, you know, look, your best chance is to take this plea and go ahead and serve some time. And that may be, you know, a responsible thing for the public defender to say, given the workload and given the circumstances. But I think you're right to say that if you're wealthy enough, you could afford to fight the charges, and you'd have a better chance of avoiding jail. I think the larger problem, though, even larger than that, is because you have a population that's been underemployed, as you say, that it is often in circumstances where job opportunities are very hard to come by, and in environments where there's lots of criminal activity, gangs and the like, that's a group of people who are more likely to get mixed up in crime in one way or another. And that, too, is a reason that we have such a disproportionate number of racial minorities mixed up in the criminal justice system.
A lot of people today who are trying to understand where racism lives and why it persists, we'll talk about an element of classism in the whole thing. But you also have several examples in the book of very prominent, wealthy people of color feeling as if they were directly impacted by racism. Can you give us a little perspective on that?
Sure. Well, I think that that's one of the examples that I've been giving do mainly have to do with poverty. And that's because I think that's where the most severe racial injustices lie. However, to be sure, wealthy people also suffer from racism, and you know, they're right to complain about that when they do. What I worry about, though, and what I write about in the book, is that in some circumstances, very wealthy people are complaining about what are relatively trivial or ambiguous slights. So, one example, with Oprah Winfrey, you might have heard about this, but went to Paris and tried to go to the Hermes boutique in Paris, and it was turned away. And the story got a lot of press and a lot of attention on the internet right away. You know, even Oprah Winfrey is turned away by racists in Paris who wouldn't let her into the Hermes store. Now, first, it sounds pretty bad, but the backstory was that the store had actually closed. It was past the closing hours, and the staff was trying to usher people out toward the door when Oprah Winfrey arrived. And so they didn't let her in because the store was closed. You know, that puts things in a slightly different light. And so to attribute that to racism is, you know, is questionable. Now, in Oprah Winfrey's defense, she wasn't the one who said it was racism, but a companion of hers had said something like it was her Crash moment, referring to the film Crash that involved lots of racial incidents. And then other people immediately jumped in to say it's like separate water fountains and, you know, in the Jim Crow South. So there's one example. Another example, the rapper Jay-Z complained about an interview that the head of Cristal Champagne, or the Roto-Rare Champagne House that makes Cristal, had given, in which the man suggested that the hip-hop culture might be unwelcome attention, or it might be not the public image that the brand was looking to portray. And a lot of this, the interview was quite ambiguous at any rate, and a lot of this came as a result of the reporters editorializing as opposed to what the man had actually said. But anyway, the upshot was that Jay-Z said that this was racist, and he was going to launch a boycott of the champagne. Now, again, this is not only relatively trivial in the overall scheme of racial injustices, and one has to ask whether a boycott of prestige cuvée champagne is a good use of resources in a world in which we have as many real and severe racial injustices as we do. But in addition, the comment was ambiguous. It wasn't clear whether the person was concerned about hip-hop in particular as opposed to blacks in general. And in fact, everything seemed to suggest that the issue was gangster rap and hip-hop and not African-Americans. So to call it racist was a bit of a stretch. That's another example of, you know, a fairly wealthy person using the prestige, if you will, of the civil rights movement in order to attack what's a relatively trivial and indeed ambiguous racial slight.
So if it's just as wrong to automatically assume racism as it is to automatically deny that it's a possibility, what tools would we use to find our way to the truth in any given situation?
Well, I think that I'd like to see us focus more on these most, on the most severe problems that, again, have to do with poverty and the isolation of the black poor in ghetto neighborhoods. And in those circumstances, we really don't need to point the finger of blame. We don't have to find the racist. We can just look at this as a social problem that requires pragmatic solutions. And there are plenty of pragmatic solutions that we could implement, things like revitalizing inner-city economies, jobs programs. The sociologist William Julius Wilson, for instance, has suggested that we need a WPA for the inner city. I think that's a great idea that deserves serious consideration. Do something about neighborhood segregation, and then we don't need to try to hunt for the bigot. In the more ambiguous situations, in many cases, I think these things really have to be, we have to just let some of these things go, that when the facts are ambiguous, it's a mistake to insist that the issue is racism and to point the finger of blame. And my worry there is that it turns a lot of people off, that it alienates people of goodwill who may otherwise be our allies in the more serious racial struggles to hear people complaining about things that are ambiguous or that strike them, making accusations that are unfair.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Richard Thompson Ford. His book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Let's go next to Plano and speak with Robert. Hey, Robert.
Hey, I would be interested in Richard's opinion on this. I'm a person of mixed race, and I get confused and offended when I hear about discussions of reparations for blacks that you know, whites or others are supposed to give them. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
Right, the reparations debate is interesting. It seems to me that I understand your frustration with the question of reparations when the claim is that whites or society at large should transfer wealth from one group to another. And it does seem to me that given the amount of time that's passed between the injury, if it's reparations for slavery that we're talking about here, and the difficulty of identifying the people who were to blame for the injury, that that's unlikely to be a viable solution to the problem. And quite honestly, I think that a lot of the argument about reparations for slavery really, at core, is motivated by the plight of the black underclass. And that's a group that I do think deserves our sympathy, and I do think deserves our support in terms of public policy. I just wouldn't put it in terms of reparations, which again suggests that we're taking money from a group of people who are blameworthy and giving it to a group of people who deserve the money. Instead, I'd like to see us look at this as a collective social problem and something that we would work toward collectively without the idea that that one group of people, whites or whomever, are as a group, as a collective, by virtue of their race, to blame for the problem.
Let's go next to Dallas and speak with Max. Hey, Max.
Oh, how's it going? I wanted to first thank the author for coming on the air and talking about such a difficult subject to express. I had one question about white flight and education, but it seems to me that the conversation has taken a different turn. And my next question would be about if the author could talk a little bit about social inequality and stratification and how some agents in society tend to reinforce what's already there.
Interesting. Well, there's a lot of stratification in our society that I'm concerned about, and I think there are many things that do tend to reinforce it. And again, I wouldn't say that that is primarily in today's environment due to racism or racial animus, but there are a lot of institutions and forces that reinforce the stratification that we have in our society. Here's just one example. I talked about neighborhood segregation and how that leads to failing schools, or minorities being disproportionately stuck in failing schools. Well, one thing that in many parts of the United States reinforces that is that we fund public schools through property taxes. And the result is that wealthier areas where property values are high have more revenue to spend on schools, even if they tax the tax rate is relatively low. Poor areas where property values are low don't have much to spend on schools, even if their tax rate is relatively high. You add to that the fact that we typically, not always, but typically assign children to school based on their residence, based on neighborhood, and you can begin to see the way way that we've organized schools and funding perpetuates inequality and generates a situation in which the people who are most well off get most of the benefit, and the people who need the most wind up with the least.
Richard Thompson Ford is with us. He's George E. Osborne Professor of Law at Stanford. His book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. You can send an email to the conversation. That goes to think@kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Thompson Ford. His book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending emails to think@kera.org. You have been very critical of the multicultural movement and the impact that it's had on society. Can you talk about why you see multiculturalism as a less effective tool for guaranteeing equality than assimilation?
Well, my concern about multiculturalism, let me also say that some aspects of multiculturalism have been a good thing, and the term is actually quite capacious and includes a lot of different movements. But the things that I've been critical about have to do with the attitude that the different racial groups and ethnic groups in our society each come with a different culture, and that culture, the culture of the racial group, is so central to the lives of the members of the group that if someone or an institution dislikes or disagrees with or even doesn't celebrate the culture of that group, that's the same thing as racism. So if you don't accept some aspect of what someone might define as black culture, for instance, there was a big debate about Ebonics, and one of the ideas that you got out of some versions of multiculturalism was that if you tried to teach kids not to speak Ebonics, but instead to speak more standard English, that was cultural discrimination, and it was basically the same thing as racism. And I think that attitude is a big mistake. Now, there are lots of interesting debates about in the Ebonics context about how one should go about teaching children to read and to master language when their home environment may be one that doesn't use standard English. As a pedagogical matter, these are interesting debates. But what I think is a mistake is to say that we have to teach Ebonics or to suggest that the children ought to learn and master standard English is a form of discrimination. I think that's something that sets kids up for failure is going to make it harder for them to integrate into the mainstream of the economy, get good jobs and have prosperous lives.
I guess whether or not it's entirely accurate, a lot of people see the dominant culture of the United States as being sort of European white Judeo-Christian culture. Mm-hmm. And then they would argue that assimilation forces people to subscribe to a broader culture that they feel excludes them.
Right. I understand people say that. I think that mainstream culture in the United States is increasingly itself multicultural, in the sense that the contributions of people from a variety of cultural backgrounds have become part of the mainstream. It'd be very hard to understand American culture, for instance, without reference to the contributions of African Americans in music, in literature, in oratory. It would be hard to understand the culture of much of the United States, particularly the Southwest, without reference to the contributions of Latin America. Again, in terms of music, in terms of literature, in terms of cuisine, in terms of lifestyle. So I think that American culture is already, in many ways, a hybrid. But that doesn't mean that there's no place for institutions and groups to have and to expect to have a common culture that cuts across racial boundaries and that cuts across cultural boundaries. I think sometimes that's vital. It's vital for an institution to have a job culture or a culture of the workplace that brings everyone together. It can be vital for a school or a university to have traditions and institutions that bring everyone together and cut across ethnic divisions. And so, and when the multicultural movement suggests that that's not acceptable, that that's discrimination, I think that's wrong, and I think that's something that would make it impossible for us to have integrated institutions that really work.
Let's go next to Denton and speak with Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was pondering, I'm having a bit of a catch-22 right now. I have a brother who he and I, we debate upon various, consciousness, we have a varying consciousness of race. And he has a much more, what I look at is tactless. And I get very, subjective in my arguments. I get very angry, and I don't know, and as well as with, when I confront racism in a very hostile way, I find it very demeaning, and I need to keep a cool head about it. But when it comes to this with my brother, I try, when it comes to more ambiguous comments that he makes, I just shrug it off. But something that's blatantly racist, I'm like, hey, you can't say that. Mm-hmm. That's obsolete. It kind of ends there, and it turns into kind of a fight. But I was wondering if you had any advice on how to combat basically racism in our everyday lives. Whether it's a comment that's made or somebody's, how to question the status quo. What's the best way to go about that in an objective way?
Great. I think it's important that we do continue to confront racism when it's a clear and unambiguous case of racism. And so, I wouldn't want anything I've said to suggest that we not continue to fight bigoted attitudes and racial animus when they appear in our society. And there's certainly that kind of racism is not dead. It's a problem for us. But I think that when we deal with the ambiguous cases, it's important to, be more circumspect and to take into account that there may be ambiguity, to consider the possibility that the situation that's bothering us may not be the result of racism, but could be the result of something more complicated. And that's true for several reasons. One, it's true so that we reserve the strong moral condemnation for real cases of racism where it belongs. And that, I think, will enable us to be more forceful in condemning real and unambiguous racism. What's happening now too often is that we kind of dilute the moral condemnation that ought to be reserved for racism by calling lots of things racism that may not be, or that may not, where it may be unclear. And then in the more ambiguous cases, it's important for us to be able to see the root of the real problem, which may or may not be simple color prejudice, as I put it before. But if we can see the totality of the problem, then we'd be more likely to come up with viable solutions.
Given the extraordinary power and symbolism, though, of language, is it reasonable to worry that letting go of what has been a relentless attack on what you call trivial slights, innocent slips of the tongue, and well-intentioned, if controversial, decisions will allow us to backslide into a more pronounced and invidious form of racism, such as we had years ago?
Well, I think that that's unlikely. I think that provided we, again, continue to be as vigilant and as ever about the clear cases of racism, I think in the ambiguous cases, what I'm suggesting is simply that we acknowledge that they're ambiguous. You know, right now, when one has an ambiguous case and some people insist that it's racism, the result is not that everyone agrees and falls into lockstep. Instead, what we get is kind of a predictable pattern of debate about whether or not it's racism. And, you know, we see this on the media all the time, on TV. The talking heads kind of trot out and say, well, this is just another example of racism in our society. But then the person on the other side says, come on, that's not racism. You're just playing the race card. And we get this sort of predictable and tedious back and forth. That, I think, is what's bad for race relations, because it leads to skepticism on the part of a lot of people who may otherwise be of good will. There are plenty of people, I think, that now, when they hear an accusation of racism, kind of roll their eyes and say, oh, brother, here we go again. I see this on the part of some of my students in law school. You know, here we go again, someone crying racism, because they've heard it so often in circumstances where it wasn't they didn't feel it was merited, and you know, a simple fatigue for the discussion about racism, when in fact we do have real racial inequities in our society that need to be confronted with energy and with vigor. So my concern is that we're actually taking a step backward in making the accusation where it's not warranted, and we're losing the goodwill of and the energy and the commitment of a lot of people. And again, I think that's the most important legacy of the civil rights movement, is the change in attitudes and the creation of goodwill among a broad cross-section of Americans to fight discrimination. And if we lose that, then we really are in trouble, and then we are likely to slide back.
Let's go next to Jamie in Arlington. Hello, Jamie.
Hi. My question is about drug policy, and you talked a little earlier about, or mentioned, I guess, the disparate impact of some laws on racial groups. And I know, for example, that the penalties are different, the sentences anyways, for crack and cocaine, and that also
right.
tends to correspond to racial differences. And I also know that some drugs were originally outlawed, you know, at least in part, due to some racial issues. And I wondered, if we changed the drug policy, how far do you think that would go in changing this institutionalized racism?
Right, a great question. I think in terms of disparate impact, not racial animus, which I'll address in a moment, but just in terms of the impact, the war on drugs has been one of the main causes of the disproportionate representation of minorities in prison, that there are so many people in prison on relatively minor drug offenses. And so I think that if we changed and reformed those laws, admitted that the war on drugs has now become a quagmire, and shifted away to a public health focus rather than exclusively focused on criminal enforcement, which is the way we're dealing with drugs now, that would make a huge difference, and it would improve the racial disparities in the criminal justice system quite a lot. You know, now, that having been said, I don't want to suggest that the people who think that we should have a law and order approach, or the people that have voted for or supported stronger criminal sanctions, are racists. That's not, I'm sure that many of the people who supported those laws supported them with good intentions and in good faith. And I just happen to think that they're mistaken, and I think that each passing year demonstrates that that's a policy that's not working. But it's different. That's different than saying that the people are racist for having done it. And just to take the crack and powder cocaine disparity for a minute, the crack cocaine trade was the source of a huge amount of violence in many American cities, particularly during the late 80s and 90s, and many people, including some prominent black civic organizations, called for a stronger law enforcement approach, specifically directed at crack cocaine, because it was the crack trade that was generating lots of gang warfare and turf warfare and drive-by shootings and violence. And so the decision to put the harsher penalties on crack cocaine was understandable in that context. And I don't think it's fair just to say that it was racist, although my own view is that it was a mistake and that it's proven to be a mistake and it's had lots of cost for our society.
What obligations would you assign to people, individuals, who believe that they have been hurt by racism?
What obligations would I assign to them? Well, I think the main obligation is to look closely at the circumstances and try to determine with as cool a head as possible whether or not racism, in fact, was in play, or whether we're looking at a situation in which something unfortunate happened, and but the person who's presided over the situation may not be a racist. But I think that's the main thing to look at, that if we could say, you know, okay, I'm upset. Something bad has happened to me. Now, is it racism or not? And try to really think it with a cool head about that question before accusing someone of being a racist. That's the main obligation. Now, I also think that there are ways to raise the question of racial justice without accusing someone of being a racist, and that's an obligation if, in fact, one comes to the conclusion that the person in question isn't a racist, but perhaps has done something that inadvertently caused a racial problem, that it's appropriate that we...
We're out of time, Richard. I'm so sorry. The new book is called The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Richard Thompson Ford, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Hi, this is Jeff Whittington inviting you to participate in KERA's Fundraising Power Hour this Friday. Your contribution supports the station's mission to provide quality, informative public radio in North Texas. Now, there's a $5,000 challenge grant to beat the all-time record for money raised during a power hour, so it's especially important that you become a member, renew your membership, or make an additional gift this Friday morning. Every contribution will make a difference. So call or go online to make your donation this Friday between 7 and 8 a.m. Thanks for your support.
It's 12:59. You're listening to your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth-Denton. And as always, we're online at kera.org. In Tyler, it's K261 CW 100.1. We're at K202DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman. It's 1 o'clock.
I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, myths and truths about the legendary Roman triumph. These storied ceremonies celebrated Roman military achievements, elevating victorious generals to dizzying heights of admiration and ensuring they would enjoy wealth and power for the rest of their lives. Classics scholar Mary Beard agrees the concept of a triumph is fascinating, but she is convinced that much of what experts think they know about these civil and religious pageants could be wrong. We'll talk about why when our conversation starts after the news from National Public Radio.